Lecture 11, The Deadliest Conspiracy Theory in History. June 28, 1914, dawn clear and sunny in Sarajevo, the capital of Bosnia-Herzegovina, a small Balkan province under the imperial control of Austria-Hungary, governed by the aging Habsburg Emperor Franz Joseph. Joseph's heir apparent, the 51-year-old Archduke Franz Ferdinand, was in town with his wife, the Duchess Sophie Chotek, to inspect the army's summer maneuvers, to open a new state museum, to visit the local magistrates, and to recognize St. Vitus's Day, the anniversary of the 1389 Battle of Kosovo, in which Serbs were humiliated in defeat, which was not exactly what everyone in town wanted to celebrate. The couple cruised down the historic Apelkwe Boulevard in their Graf and Stift double Phaeton sports coupe, top down so the throngs of well-wishers could see royalty in the making, dressed as they were in the ostentatious finery of the day. He wore a cavalry dress uniform of blue tunic, gold collar with three silver stars, and a helmet with green peacock feathers. She sported a white hat and veil and a long white silk dress with red and white fabric roses. This, despite the warnings they received the day before that a terrorist attack was possible, even likely. As Sophie told one of her hosts, "Everywhere we have gone here, we have been treated with so much friendliness, and by every last Serb, too, with so much cordiality and unsimulated warmth that we are very happy about it." Among those not there to welcome the royal couple were Serbian nationalists not keen on being subjects of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The empire's 1908 annexation of Bosnia-Herzegovina led to the radicalization of certain Serbian nationalist groups. And 3 years later, on March 3, 1911, a secret society called the Black Hand was formed in a Belgrade apartment. Serbia's independence was recognized at the Congress of Berlin in 1878, but Bosnian Serbs dreamed of uniting their country with Serbia into a greater Serbia. The forthcoming elevation of Franz Ferdinand to emperor was believed by Bosnian Serbs to pose a threat to their irredentist plans. In response, Black Hand operatives radicalized, armed, and positioned six assassins among the crowd as the motorcade of automobiles glided down the boulevard, their targets in the second car impossible to miss. The assassins knew where to go because the parade route was published in the papers to ensure a large welcome. Security forces were conspicuous by their absence. Among the six assassins was Gavrilo Princip, a school dropout who sought refuge with Serbian guerrilla fighters and dreamed of one day freeing all southern Slavs. "I am a Yugoslav nationalist, aiming for the unification of all Yugoslavs, and I do not care what form of state, but it must be free from Austria," Princip later explained at his trial. As Princip was the key that opened the conspiracy lock, much of the follow-up investigation into the assassination centered on this 19-year-old. Who was he? And how far up did the conspiracy go? That is the subject of investigative journalist Tim Butcher's 2014 book, The Trigger: Hunting the Assassin Who Brought the World to War. Gavrilo Princip was born in 1894 in a tiny hamlet in western Bosnia, the son of a dirt-poor feudal serf. There was long-standing resentment against Austria-Hungary, which was seen as a foreign power occupying their land. As was not uncommon at the time, six of Gavrilo's siblings died in childbirth, and in 1907, he escaped the grinding poverty of his home and moved to Sarajevo to attend school. Butcher tracked down his school reports, which showed Gavrilo initially to be an A student, But his grades declined thereafter when he had fallen in with other young radicals who dared to think the unthinkable, doing away with Austria-Hungary. It was, therefore, seemingly foreordained that Princep would be the trigger of what, in the end, was the demise of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The historian Christopher Clark, in his magisterial book, The Sleepwalkers, How Europe Went to War in 1914, provides a detailed account of how the assassination went down. The assassins were given 4 Browning pistols and 6 small hand grenades with 12-second chemical fuses stolen from the Serbian state arsenal, along with paper packets of cyanide powder with which to commit revolutionary suicide after their mission. As the motorcade entered the kill zone, the first 2 assassins lost their nerve and failed to act. One of them later explaining, "I did not pull out the revolver because I saw that the Duchess was there. I felt sorry for her." Next in line was assassin Nedeljko Kabrinovic, who pulled his hand grenade out and initiated the detonator by smacking it against the lamppost, giving him 12 seconds to aim and hurl it at the target second vehicle. Out of the corner of his eye, the Archduke's driver spotted the missile and punched the car's accelerator, causing the bomb to skirt across the back of the car and land under the following vehicle before it detonated, wounding the passengers and a number of police and bystanders in the crowd. Franz was unharmed, while Sophie incurred a small cut on her cheek. As instructed, Kabrinovic swallowed his cyanide powder and leaped into the nearby Miljaka River, which was too shallow at this time of year for drowning. The cyanide only resulted in violent vomiting, and he was captured, beaten by the crowd, and hauled off to the police station. The vehicle sped off to safety while the other assassins slunk away in defeat, the assassination conspiracy foiled by nerves, empathy, and bad luck. Even the best planned conspiracies rarely unfold according to plan, and this one was not over yet. Remarkably, and in hindsight foolishly, Franz Ferdinand decided to complete his appointed rounds, explaining, without an ounce of constructive paranoia, "Come on, that fellow is clearly insane. Let's proceed with our program." The Archduke and his associates continued on to the town hall reception for him, where Sarajevo's mayor bumbled his way through his original welcoming speech, apparently oblivious how this resonated on the heels of an attempted assassination of his guest. Quote, "All of the citizens of the capital city of Sarajevo find that their souls are filled with happiness, and they most enthusiastically greet Your Highness's most illustrious visit with the most cordial of welcomes." The Archduke upbraided his host, "I came here as your guest, and you people greet me with bombs." The Archduke then delivered his speech, acknowledging what he thought he saw in the faces of his audience, an expression of their joy at the failure of the attempt at assassination. He spoke too soon, as conspiracies often turn on the quirkiest of events. In this case, Franz Ferdinand decided to visit the hospital where his wounded comrades were being treated. Sophie Chotek canceled her plans to meet with a delegation of Muslim women at City Hall and thought it best to join her husband, another fateful decision. The delegation once again headed down the Appell Quay toward the hospital, but instead turned right on Franz Josef Street toward the National Museum, the driver apparently unaware that the museum event had been canceled. The driver stopped and put the Archduke's coupe into neutral and allowed it to slide backward onto the Appell Quay, the vehicle lacking a reverse gear. Meanwhile, dejected by the failed conspiracy, Gavrilo Princip meandered over to Moritz Schiller's delicatessen on the corner of Appell Quay and Franz Josef Street for some private consolation. Looking up at the moment of the wrong turn, Princip was astonished to see his targets paused before him. Unable to disengage his grenade from his belt, he pulled out his 9mm semi-automatic Browning pistol and fired the first shot through the door, hitting Sophie in the abdomen, severing her stomach artery, and causing her to slump into her husband's lap. After a moment of hesitation, he later told his interrogators he meant only to kill the Archduke and not the Duchess, Princep fired again, this time hitting Archduke Ferdinand in the jugular vein. As the car sped off, Franz proclaimed to his wife, "Sophie, Sophie, don't die. Stay alive for our children." As his plumed helmet slipped off his head, he said to his fellow passengers, "It's nothing, it's nothing." Those were his final words as both he and his wife fell unconscious, bled out, and died soon after. As he was trained, Princep moved to shoot himself with his pistol and swallow his cyanide, but the crowd grabbed his limbs and started pounding him into a pulp. He was rescued by the police and hauled off into custody. He was tried, jailed, and sentenced to 20 years solitary confinement. He died 4 years later, his body so badly ravaged by skeletal tuberculosis that his right arm had to be amputated. That is unfortunate indeed, as a new conspiracy theory developed shortly after Princep's capture, namely, that forces high up in the Serbian government conspired to assassinate the Archduke. Here is what Tim Butcher writes of the conspiracy theory that launched the First World War. Quote, "Vienna was desperate to use the assassination as a pretext to attack its small and potentially troublesome neighbor, Serbia. For this to work, Austria-Hungary worked to represent Princep and the assassination plot as the work of the Serbian government. And this alone is perhaps the greatest misrepresentation of the truth about Gavrilo Princep, with the historical record containing no convincing evidence to support the claim." A dramatic 2014 film titled simply Sarajevo, and well worth watching for catching the political climate of the day, follows this conspiratorial thread through the eyes of the investigator, an Austrian judge named Leo Pfeffer, who was tasked with tracing the assassins to their source. Let's consider what Pfeffer's investigation revealed, as detailed by the historian Christopher Clark. At first, Princep insisted that he acted alone, claiming he was surprised to hear Kabrinovich's grenade explosion, and Kabrinovich seemed to confirm that fact, also proclaiming that he was a lone assassin, insisting he procured the explosive device from an anarchist in Belgrade, the capital of Serbia. The next day, however, Kabrinovich admitted he and Princep were accomplices who had planned the assassination together in Belgrade, explaining that they obtained their weapons from unnamed Belgrade partisans. His story now betrayed, Princep admitted he worked in cahoots with Kabrinovich, and they kept their story straight by communicating in prison through a code of knocks they learned about in a Russian novel. A police dragnet uncovered one of the Black Hand operatives named Danilo Ilic, who attempted a plea bargain to avoid the death penalty in exchange for revealing more conspiratorial details, starting with the fact that Princep and Kabrinovich were not the only assassins, naming the others and identifying their whereabouts. The next step in the investigation was to determine if the plot could be traced all the way up to the Serbian government. The pistols were of Serbian make, and the bombs were from a Serbian armory, so that was more than a little suggestive. And although many Serbs expressed delight that Archduke Franz Ferdinand was killed, additional information gathering uncovered no direct links to the Serbian state. Although Pfeffer concluded that this was not an officially state-sanctioned hit by the Serbian government, the Austro-Hungarian foreign minister, Leopold von Berchtold, was keen on finding an excuse to squelch the rising ambitions of Serbia, which was backed by its strong Slavic ally, Russia. So, 2 days after the assassination, on June 30, Berchtold presented a final and fundamental reckoning with Serbia to the Austrian emperor, the 84-year-old Franz Joseph, who agreed to consult with his ally, the German Kaiser Wilhelm. On July 5, the Kaiser gave Berchtold what came to be known in history as the blank check promise that Germany would support Austria-Hungary if it attacked Serbia. Given these underlying currents, it might not have mattered that on July 13th, another investigator from the Austro-Hungarian Foreign Office, one Friedrich von Wiesner, issued his findings to Berchtold that were unequivocal. Quote, "There is nothing to prove or even suppose that the Serbian government is accessory to the inducement for the crime, its preparation, or the furnishing of weapons. On the contrary, there are reasons to believe that this is altogether out of the question." What all this means is that the Austro-Hungarian assumption of Serbian complicity in the assassination was very likely mistaken, or worse, a contrived conspiracy theory for the purpose of justifying a war it was already bent on initiating. And so, the worst war in the history of humanity up to that date was arguably pointless. The consequences of the events that unfolded in Sarajevo on June 28, 1914, cannot be exaggerated. At the time, the great powers of Europe were divided by treaties and alliances into two grand coalitions: the Triple Entente of Britain, France, and Russia, and the Triple Alliance of Italy, Germany, and Austria-Hungary. Once Austria-Hungary decided that the conspiracy to assassinate Franz Ferdinand was orchestrated by Serbia and was not solely the work of the rogue organization, the Black Hand, it retaliated on July 28, 1914, by bombarding the Serbian capital of Belgrade. Russia was obligated by treaty to back Serbia, so it mobilized its troops on July 30. The next day, Austria-Hungary and Germany mobilized to counter the Russian buildup, and on August 1, Germany declared war on Russia in support of Austria-Hungary, the latter of which declared war on Russia 5 days later, on August 6. In support of Russia, France ordered full mobilization on August 2. Not wanting a two-front war, Germany invaded France through neutral Belgium in hopes of defeating it in 4 weeks, after which it could concentrate on the Russian front. Since Britain was obligated by treaty to defend Belgium, and in support of France, it too declared war on Germany on August 4th and on Austria-Hungary on August 12th. It was a full-on continental war. As the war virus spread, Japan sided with the Entente and seized German possessions in China and the Pacific. And over the ensuing months and years, much of the rest of the world, including the United States in 1917, joined the world's first global conflict. When that conflict finally ended in 1918, it left an estimated body count of 9 million combatants and 7 million civilians, plus tens of millions more who died in related genocides and the horrific influenza pandemic that struck weakened populations. Sometimes real conspiracies can be catastrophic, and it all turned on those 6 seconds on a street corner in Sarajevo. This is how conspiracies really work, as messy events that unfold according to real-time contingencies and often turn on the minutiae of chance and the quirkiness of human error. In a previous lecture, we discussed the two conspiracy theories about 9/11, that President Bush made it happen on purpose, MIHOP, or that he let it happen on purpose, LIHOP. Neither one of these applies to what Austria-Hungary did in attacking Serbia after the assassination of Franz Ferdinand and Sophie Chotek. Instead, they did what many states have done when they want to do something that is immoral, illegal, or both. They capitalized on an event that happened for other reasons. Call it capitalized on what happened on purpose, cowhop. The 9/11 conspiracy theory about Bush was neither myhop or liehop. It was cowhop, capitalized on what happened on purpose. After the first Gulf War in 1991 that successfully repelled the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, the State Department determined that Saddam Hussein's own people would likely overthrow him in good time. And regime change like that is always better coming from within instead of without. When it didn't happen, and Hussein regained his power and continued abusing his own people, including using poison gas, there was strong incentive to overthrow his abusive and dangerous dictatorship and try to install a democracy. Since states can no longer legally just start wars and invade foreign countries, I will explain why shortly, the United States capitalized on the 9/11 tragedy, first by correctly invading Afghanistan, which did harbor the real conspirators, and second by invading Iraq, which had nothing to do with 9/11. Why, we might ask, do nations like the United States go to all the bother of justifying their military actions? Why didn't President Kennedy go all in for a takeover of Cuba with a massive strike force comparable to D-Day and be done with the Castro regime in a matter of days? Why didn't President Nixon simply send in several hundred thousand American troops into Chile to topple the Allende regime? Why didn't President Bush just invade Iraq without bothering with a UN resolution involving dozens of other nations in a willing coalition that wasn't much of either? After all, the Roman Empire didn't bother with false flag operations in order to explain to other empires why they invaded this or that foreign country. In the infamous words of Julius Caesar, Veni, Vidi, Vici, I came, I saw, I conquered. No conspiracies were necessary because such actions were routinely conducted out in the open. Today, conspiracies are necessary because something dramatic happened in 1928. War was outlawed. Say what? In their 2017 book, The Internationalists, How a Radical Plan to Outlaw War Remade the World, Una Hathaway and Scott Shapiro begin with the contorted legal machinations of lawyers, legislators, and politicians in the 17th century that made war, in the words of the Prussian military theorist Karl von Clausewitz, the continuation of politics by other means. Those means included a license to kill other people, take their stuff, and occupy their land, legally. How did this happen? In 1625, the renowned Dutch jurist Hugo Grotius penned a 500-page legal justification for his country's capture of the Portuguese merchant ship Santa Catarina when these two countries were at war. The document was titled The Law of War and Peace, and it argued that if individuals have rights that can be defended through courts, then nations have rights that can be defended through war. Why? Because there was no world court to adjudicate disputes between nations. As a consequence, for four centuries, nations have felt at liberty to justify their bellicosity through war manifestos, legal documents outlining their just causes for just wars. Hathaway and Shapiro compiled over 400 such documents into a database on which they conducted a content analysis. That is, a catalog of reasons why nations said they had to fight. The most common rationalizations for war were self-defense, 69%, enforcing treaty obligations, 47%, compensation for tortious injuries, 42%, violations of the laws of war or law of nations, 35%, stopping those who would disrupt the balance of power, 33%, and protection of trade interests, 19%. These war manifestos are, in short, an exercise in motivated reasoning, employing the confirmation bias, the hindsight bias, and other cognitive heuristics to justify a predetermined end. Instead of, I came, I saw, I conquered, these declarations read more like, I was just standing there, minding my own business, when he threatened me. I had to defend myself by attacking him. The problem with this arrangement is obvious. Call it the moralization bias, the belief that our cause is moral and just, and anyone who disagrees is not just wrong, but immoral. In 1917, with the carnage of the First World War evident to all, a Chicago corporate lawyer named Salmon Levinson reasoned, we should have, not as now, laws of war, but laws against war. Just as there are no laws of murder or of poisoning, but laws against them. With the support of the American philosopher John Dewey, the French Foreign Minister Aristide Briand, the German Foreign Minister Gustav Stresemann, and the U.S. Secretary of State Frank B. Kellogg, Levinson's arguments came to fruition with the General Treaty for the Renunciation of War, also known as the Kellogg-Briand Pact, signed in Paris in 1928. War was outlawed. Given the number of wars since 1928, not the least of which was the Second World War that exceeded in carnage its predecessor, what happened? The moralization bias was dialed up to 11, of course, but there was also a lack of enforcement. That began to change after the ruinous Second World War, when the concept of outcasting took hold, the most common example being economic sanctions. Instead of doing something to the rule breakers, Hathaway and Shapiro explain, outcasters refused to do something with the rule breakers. This principle of exclusion doesn't always work, but sometimes it does. And it is almost always better than war. The result, the researchers show, is that interstate war has declined precipitously and conquests have almost completely disappeared. Just because the outline of war has not eliminated war is no more reason to give up on it than that we should eliminate laws against murder just because homicide rates have not bottomed out at zero. They have, in fact, dropped precipitously over the centuries, as have international wars. So the system works, even if not perfectly so. For example, the Correlates of War Project, the best and most thorough data set ever assembled on military conflict, shows that the more two countries trade with one another, the less likely they are to fight. It's not a perfect correlation, there are exceptions, but countries that are economically interdependent are less likely to allow political tensions to escalate to the point of conflict. Wars are expensive. Economic duties, sanctions, embargoes, and blockades are costly, and business often suffers on both sides of a conflict, except weapons manufacturers, of course. Thus, the sooner nations like North Korea and Iran can be brought into economic trading blocks that make them codependent with the nuclear great powers, the less likely they are to feel the need to develop nuclear weapons in the first place, much less use them. Research also shows that the more democratic two nations are, the less likely they are to fight. As with economic interdependence, democratic peace is a general trend, not a law of nature, but the effect is found in the transparency of a political system that includes checks and balances on power and the ability to change leaders, so that a liar lunatic or lord wannabe obsessed with power, intent on revenge, or fixated on a nation's racial purity or precious bodily fluids will not be allowed to escalate tensions to the point of launching nuclear-tipped missiles. Outcasting works reasonably well to keep rogue nations in check, particularly in the form of economic sanctions. Before war was outlawed, there was, on average, approximately one conquest every 10 months, or 1.21 conquests per year. between 1816 and 1928, with an average amount of real estate lost at 295,486 square kilometers per year, the equivalent of about 11 Crimeas per year for over a century. When outcasting took hold after the Second World War, the average number of conquests fell to 0.26 per year, with an average annual loss of 14,950 square kilometers. That's progress. So, the world has changed drastically since the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand. And it is much to be hoped that current international relations are such that the actions of a small group of conspirators will never again spiral into global war and the deaths of tens of millions of people, as it did after those 6 seconds in Sarajevo. But at the same time, we need to recognize that real conspiracies can still lead to devastating conflicts, especially when political leaders are prepared to capitalize on them. In the late 19th century, as democracies fought to get a toehold, climbing the precipitous cliffs of absolute monarchies and other autocracies, the historian Lord Acton penned this observation: "Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Great men are almost always bad men." Let's add an axiom to Acton's maxim: power tends to corrupt conspiracies, and absolute power corrupts conspiracy theories. In the next lecture, the last in this course, we will explore a slew of conspiracies and conspiracy theories that began shortly after the First World War and accelerated in popularity throughout the 20th century and into the current century, as both governments and corporations grew in power, and see how we must be vigilant to prevent power from corrupting when real conspiracies take root.